Davidson's theory ordinarily applies to spoken discourse and builds its universal claim from instances of face-to-face interaction. According to Davidson, language and thought depend on the epistemic triangulation of the self, other minds, and the external world. But daily experience entails many situations that lack the essential second person. What happens when the speaker is missing? More specifically, how can Davidson's theory apply to written utterances? Manners are not as easy as substituting the original triangulation with its literary equivalent of reader, writer, and text. Davidson characterizes the process of radical interpretation in the projection of beliefs, intentions, and desires to formulate a speaker's meaning, but the author, their propositional attitudes, and their nonverbal behavior are not available to the interpreter. What does an interpreter do then? How do they attribute beliefs, desires, and intentions to the missing writer? Furthermore, the concept of radical interpretation of verbal speech acts contains criteria for correctness. Can any textual interpretation be considered the correct one? If so, what are the criteria to distinguish between competing interpretations? The relationship between the fictional and the exterior world needs to be established, and the status of external interpretation in relation to other propositional attitudes needs to be clarified. Davidson said little that directly addressed these questions. However, his notions of triangulation and radical interpretation are valuable for literary theory, particularly for explaining underlying assumptions and the expected roles of writers and readers. Davidson's coherence theory offers interesting implications. On the one hand, holism of the mental maintains interpretive indeterminacy, but on the other hand, it opposes hermeneutic pragmatism and its interrelated relativism by reinstating the importance of authorial intentions. Even though writers' intentions are a feature of contemporary hermeneutic theories wish to dispel, their role receives an entirely different status when Davidson's coherence theory is applied to literature. I will start with essential background concepts in Davidson's theory. To begin with, Davidson's notion of triangulation has an important dual meaning. First, triangulation is a pre-linguistic and pre-cognitive situation that conditioned the development of thought and language. The emergence of thought and language involved simultaneous interaction of at least two agents with each other and with their shared world. Given an already developed conceptual and linguistic ability, one can act sensibly in the absence of a referential world or another interpreter to verify or modify employed concepts. Triangulation's second sense demands a periodic confrontation with a second person, the exterior world, or both. For every once in a while, our continually modified conceptions need to be tested for coherence with the perceptions of others and correspondence with the world. The last relevant background information is Davidson's distinction between prior and passing theories. The former, prior theory, is an agent's default initial strategy for interpreting any given speech act, whereas passing theory is the actual method employed. Speakers of a language assume common prior theories and direct their interpreters toward passing theories they wish to have implemented. Textual interpretation also implies a twofold character of triangulation, similar to its spoken equivalent, only to one level removed. Instead of the pre-linguistic and pre-cognitive triangulation, the written depends on the post-speaking, pre-reading conditioning. Its second contingent sense assumes the existence of a reading-writing tradition and the essential absence of the author. In what follows, I will characterize these twofold components and search for their role in textual interpretation. So I begin with the first fictional triangulation, which I call transcendental and in part categorical. Written language is a form of communication, thus necessarily social. However, in most cases, reading is not performed publicly, except in events like these. It is usually done privately and individually. However, involving thought and language, it is also social in essence. How do these two characteristics coreside? Davidson's reply is that writing and reading are traditions that depend on the prior existence of a wide body of shared conceptualization and previous exposure to linguistic usage. In order to make sense of literary texts, readers must be familiar with ordinary linguistic use and realize the dependence of the written on the spoken. In this sense, Davidson considers the literary use of language in a similar way to J.L. Austin, as etiolated and parasitical to regular spoken use. As such, textual interpretation is similar to that of oral speech. It has no pre-existing conventions that produce firm and determinate meanings. Furthermore, reading and writing involve a triangular conceptual agreement that produces social conditioning for intersubjective hermeneutic strategies. Fictional triangulation's transcendental sense embodies various features that create a tradition. This tradition conditions textual interpretations and results in efforts to maximize agreement between writers and readers. The first significant character of this tradition involves projecting norms of rationality. The reading-writing tradition depends on a common background and charitable attribution of logic and rationality that provide the essential intersubjective preconditions for the interpretation of written acts. Interpretation of written sentences demand attributing the writer with a threefold intention of using selected words in order to be understood in a certain way and as having a particular force to achieve a specific goal. This entails a mutual agreement that the writer wishes to be understood in a certain way and that the reader wishes to understand what the writer wants to express. Most importantly, the custom of writing and reading also maintains that both sides are aware of the deficient triangulation. Writers and readers assume their respective tasks, realizing the other mind will not be present. Both sides are aware of the means available for meeting these intentions. Writer and reader attribute the principle of charity respectively. The writer assumes that their readers, if those exist, are rational and coherent thinking agents, and vice versa. Like in spoken interaction, the roles of writer and reader continuously interchange. The reader assumes the writer's role in making sense of the words used, determining what they mean, what force they have, and what goal they serve applied in a particular way. The reverse is also the case. The writer takes on the reader's role in choosing how to employ their language in such a fashion as to be understood correctly. Writing and reading replace witnessing the visual or audio performance with efforts at imagining them. Each side imagines the other side's implementation of a written utterance in its contextual setting. Even though when producing or receiving discourse, nothing in advance ensures getting things right, an author has a good sense of how the clues left in the text will be understood. Davidson asserts that, quote, "This interplay between writer and reader is, and is meant to be, routine, in the sense that the writer knows pretty well how he or she is apt to be understood, and the typical reader knows pretty well how the writer intended to be understood." The standard of Tarski's T sentences remains the model for determining which arrangement of things in the textual world would render the cognitive content of a literary utterance true or false. Readers cannot but project their norms of rationality, truth conditions, and propositional attitudes for interpretation to be possible. Therefore, the literary work as a product of a rational agent is attuned to this prerequisite. Since any two people have different beliefs, experiences, and desires, idiolects will differ, interpretations vary, and it is not surprising that both sides can get it wrong. A writer may misconceive which textual clues would best convey a specific meaning, or overestimate readers' abilities. Davidson introduces the criterion of reasonable authorial intentions, which means that a writer attempting successful communication must consider the audience, its knowledge, and capacities. Another conditioning element of the reading-writing tradition is genre. A particular style, form, or content is socially characterized as a genre or literary category. Where applicable, a genre type is part of literary interpretation's prior theory, providing an expected style and a specific method to express semantic meaning. Genre is not a guiding convention, but another character comprising readers' and writers' prior theories. For genre to shape hermeneutic strategies, readers need to know in advance something about the genre and suspect that the text at hand belongs to this genre. The concept of genre introduces another contingent element that shapes readers' prior theories. These factors include any information about the book at hand, its historical and cultural tradition, biographical familiarity, and any other vantage point that shape our expectations and anticipated meaning. While the previous characteristics are necessary and shape prior theories in general, these last ones are contingent, determined by particular prejudice in relation to specific texts. Once the tradition has been established, triangulation assumes its second, historically contingent and deficient sense, becoming even more fictional once the writer is no longer a relevant factor. Readers are left with a triangular-based tradition, but a deficient or dual-angled source of correlating evidence for modifying their interpretations. The transcendental elements shape the hermeneutic process and the attribution of meaning prior to actual interpretation, whereas the contingent parts of the categorical conditioning, rooted to the reading individual, are active factors in formulating textual passing theories. Those may be reaffirmed or vary as a result of the textual encounter. So I move on now to discuss the fictional triangulation's second sense, which I called contingent or semantic. The intentional conditioning allows for written utterances to operate just as well, even when their use is absent. Davidson considers literary use of language as abusive, for there is nothing in the book that can determine the force of its sentences. Since the intentions, beliefs, and desires of the writer are missing, readers cannot distinguish between the words employed and the intentions sought by their use. This is what Davidson calls the writer's pretense of using the force of a language. Readers determine whether the force of a written utterance is that of assertion, criticism, sarcasm, or deception, according to an arbitrary, aesthetic, or any other decision about the nature of the text and its ulterior purpose. The essential inability to read the author's intentions and to witness the production of the written act leaves little evidence to identify the sought meaning and reach the belief of correct interpretation. The only exception that came to my mind is, I'm not sure you're familiar with, a Monty Python sketch where a public event is held to narrate the writing process of Thomas Hardy, and all of that is broadcasted. But otherwise, it is up to textual clues to provide corresponding evidence. The text, abiding to the intentional preconditioning, modifies a reader's prior theory, which develops toward a passing one. Writing style, detection of tone, emphasis, tempo, and other poetic devices function like an ongoing conversation, adjusting the employed passing theory to align with the textual evidence. Here, the contingent parts of our prior theory, like genre, biographical, historical, and cultural knowledge, come into effect. The text either confirms these prejudices, calls for their adjustment, or outright rejects them. The missing author can be equated with a writing style and a method of dispersing clues, so that in future encounter with this specific author or this specific writing technique, the already developed or adjusted prior theory can be reemployed. Conversely, future verbal communication will most probably not make use of this newly established conceptual space. This emphasizes once again the precedence of spoken utterances over written ones as linguistic acts that have broader consequences and communicative influences. Besides embodying its author, a text stands in causal relation with the exterior world. In providing a new fictional reality, the text can remain similar to our world in most of its characteristics, or differ wildly. In any case, a text builds on prior knowledge of the world and existing causal and referential connections. This is the case until the text varies from regular experience. For a fictional work can, and usually does, diverge from reality, and its words and sentences adopt different meanings. Davidson's account of metaphors helps explain the relation between preconditioning authorial intentions, their employed words, how those refer to the world, and readers' attribution of non-literal meanings. Davidson considers metaphors a rhetorical phenomenon through which readers attribute force, through which readers attribute force to written utterances. Metaphors in literary writings do not present any further knowledge or intention beyond their first meanings, but depend on the ordinary meaning of the words that comprise them. In relation to literary theory, referring to authorial intentions does not explain added meanings. In their particular contextual setting, usually by being patently false or trivially true, metaphors invoke thought and draw attention to something else. Most importantly, Davidson suggests that, quote, there is no limit to what a metaphor calls to our attention. Thus, he declares the limitless scope of possible interpretations. However, Davidson also claims that the correct interpretation of metaphors depends on whether the author assessed their audience properly, provided poetic devices to clearly characterize their intentions, and drew their audience to the intended meaning. So on the one hand, applying Davidson's account of metaphors to literary theory yields a plurality of possible interpretation. But on the other hand, Davidson suggests that correct understanding relies on appropriate clues that direct readers to an intended meaning. That the resulting literary theory, like Davidson's theory of communication, constrain interpretation and avoid relativism. Like verbal discourse, literary interpretation is never complete and always indeterminate. Deficient triangulation makes it even more prone to such indeterminacy. However, the conditioning intersubjective agreements limit its range and offer a sense of correct interpretation. Metaphors and literary works receive added meanings according to established preconditions of coherence and rational consistency. Davidson suggests that the intentional conditioning of clues direct interpreters toward forming correct textual interpretation. In construing cohesive interpretations and taking written clues seriously, readers follow the originating and intentional tradition and construct their textual understanding in this way. This is a loose attribution that results in a wide variety of possible interpretations, but it limits the range of correct ones. This is not to say that many cohesive interpretations get away with it, albeit rejecting from the outset any authorial intentions as relevant to any part of the interpretive process. Relativism proclaims that seeking intentions is but one cultural framework that guides interpretation. Richard Rorty, for example, writes that, quote, the only difference between texts and lumps is that we know to form and defend hypotheses about the author's intentions in the one case, but not in the other. The flip side of the coin makes coherence and following a consistent rationale the result of social conditioning and not actual authorial authority. Determining between two alternative cohesive interpretations becomes difficult, since the author's authority is missing. In accordance with Rorty, authorial intentions are common strategies in maintaining or explicating the necessary coherence of an interpretation. In the philosophy of literature, this hermeneutic strategy is called formulating the best hypothetical authorial intentions. But this confuses preconditioning authorial intentions with their actual effect, or actually the lack of their effect, on textual interpretations. The reason behind this confusion can be related to the difference between spoken and written triangulations. Verbal triangulation does not have a significant gap between its two senses, whereas fictional triangulation does. In spoken conversations, we continuously resort to the speaker to form a coherent interpretation. With the written, only when our attempt to form a coherent understanding of what is said fails, do we reintroduce historical, psychological, or biographical information to assist interpretation. Consequently, authorial intentions are mistakenly carried from the realm of determining the tradition and shaping interpretation in advance into an active variable that determines a particular textual understanding. Using the terminology of fictional triangulation's twofold senses, authorial intentions are crucial for the preconditional, transcendental, and triangular stage that determines the reading routine as searching for coherence and maximizing agreement. However, these do not take an active part in interpretation and triangulation's semantic sense. Authorial intentions mold the coherence of interpretation, but those are used as or confused for means to explain a specific textual understanding. Any coherent account of a literary work falls under the range of correct interpretation. Occam's razor helps in determining between alternatives. An interpretation that needs to tell a long story in order to maintain consistency is most likely to be mistaken. Nevertheless, communication can be sensible without full correspondence between speaker and interpreter. The leniency of fictional triangulation draws the possible similarities and differences between writers and readers even farther apart, while still permitting successful communication. In an interview conducted in 1993, Davidson asserted that, quote, "The discussion in literary criticism about intentions just seems to me to miss the fact that there are endless intentions involved in every single action. Indeed, I argue that readers' intentions take an active part in written as in spoken interpretation, whereas authorial intentions are a relevant factor prior to actual interpretation in establishing the tradition of reading and writing. The most significant of these conditioning intentions is that a text was created with the intention of being understood in a certain rational way, an assumption acknowledged by the production of any cohesive interpretation. Other attributed intentions, or the lack thereof, are already part of an interpretation and may vary in similarity or discrepancy to original authorial intentions. But that is of little interest, since communication is possible, even if at times it is based on attributing false beliefs. In the literary sphere, the preconditional sense of fictional triangulation allows interpreters, by virtue of being cohesive, to get away with it." Okay, well, I'll do it kind of, I haven't read it fully, so maybe that's even a bit, maybe that even serves the purpose even better, because I haven't read it, but I come to the reading experience with certain expectations. Part of them, and that's what I defend in the paper, are transcendental. So all of us will have probably, that's what I argue, have the same conditioning criteria that come with us to our encounter with the Iliad, say. So we pick up the book, assuming that someone wrote it. They had intentions to convey a certain meaning, and they did that through the way they wrote it. And now, if I know, and I don't know much about the Iliad, I haven't read many interpretations, or I know very little about it, but that's my prior theory, that's how I start. Anything I know about Homer, any background information, anything I read about it, talked about it, they just comprise my prior theory, what I come in with to the textual encounter. And then I start reading. And then there is no authorial intentions. And what I have in my, as part of my prior theories, are encountered with what I read. So I might, if I'm familiar with a certain genre that it belongs to, but in reading, it disconfirms that, or it's problematic for me, then while I choose either to think I know very little about this genre, or put the genre aside and just say, well, this is not applicable for this, and just construe something from the experience. Does that help answer the question? Oh, with actual criticism, I'm afraid. Well, I guess I agree with what you're saying, and I won't really indulge in, again, just because I'm not very familiar with the book anyway, but what's important for me, and as far as I think Davidson's communication theory and its application to literary theory maintains, is not that in reading the Iliad, I don't write the text just because I'm not familiar with the tradition and the culture that it came out of, but that there is an interaction. And if it's not familiar enough, as for me not to not understand what swords are, or something as extreme as that, I think that as far as Davidson's theory applies to literary theory, it is just to say that I don't have the tools to read this book or to understand it, but not that his communication theory tries to avoid, and I think successfully, relativism, and exactly saying that I write the text to read. Okay, I haven't thought about quite this question, but I think my starting point is that it's not representational, so there is no objective, if that's what you're referring to, anything that corresponds with the text. Yes. But in reading, like the narrative or what the text does, or well, according to my application, Davidson and Davidson's theory itself, I believe it stresses intersubjective and not objective. So there wouldn't be the objective correct interpretation. Well, there isn't really. I suggested that maybe Occam's razor can assist here. That kind of assuming a simplicity that an author with a preconditioning, like inserting the preconditioning triangulation, saying, well, an author wrote this text with the threefold intention, and assuming that the simplest way to make a coherent, consistent interpretation would align as much as possible with what was intended originally. But yeah, this theory does not, it gives leniency to many interpretations as possible correct ones, because exactly that the author does not take part. And there is no authorial authority to relegate one correct and the other not, as long as they are coherent. And again, you can accept that you can tell a long story to have a text make sense, but you might not want that. I'll do my best. I'm not. Again, another question I did not foresee, so this is very limited, my answer. Do you have any thoughts on that, or just? Okay, with sacred texts, it's more difficult because there's a demand for its, like really no or few other texts that demands a strong demand for it to be true that is really not applicable to other texts. That said, I mean, interpretations of the Quran say, or a strong interpretation of the Quran, or one we consider more correct to the text, would be one that is consistent or is rational. So any modern interpretation that wants to make away from, say, sexist or any other such, just want to make away of them, will have a hard time making it consistent throughout. So that poses a bit of a difficulty. Not to say that like modern interpretations, they may not wish to apply to, a coherent interpretation, but then it's clear what their intentions is, and not their, that's relativism. Okay, that's writing the text you want to read, and in my approach, it's not quite the objective that they're searching for, but there is a confrontation with the text or an encounter with it. Which means, again, I don't write the text that I read, but there is a conversation or a back and forth here.